Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Bill Zimmerman, an author, longtime activist, and one of the nation's most experienced political media consultants. Previously, he was a strategic communications consultant to MoveOn.org and candidate races that elected Senator Tim Worth, Senator Gary Hart, and Governor Tony Anaya. In 1990, he co-founded the political consulting and advertising firm Zimmerman & Markman, Incorporated, and is the author of Troublemaker, a memoir from the front lines of the 60s. His latest book is The Student Loan Swindle, Why It Happened, Who's to Blame, How the Victims Can Be Saved. And he has an article at the Huffington Post, How to Save the Victims of the Student Loan Crisis. Welcome to Background Briefing, Bill Zimmerman.
Thank you, Ian. Glad to be here.
And the student loan crisis is, as you point out in your Huffington Post piece, has all the earmarks of a repeat of the 2008 subprime housing crisis, with $1.1 trillion in unsecured educational debt, much of which will not be repaid. I've been covering for some time the more egregious and obvious part of this bigger problem, and that is the for-profit college racket, where the government gives $33 billion a year to basically a bunch of crooks who rip off students. But you're talking about a bigger picture. So paint the bigger picture, if you will, Bill.
Well, as you pointed out, there's over $1 trillion in unsecured debt. And that creates a danger to the entire economy, similar to the danger that housing debt created in 2008. We also have 40 million Americans who owe that money. Now, some of those 40 million are able to pay. They have decent jobs and can make the loan payments that are required. But many of them are recent graduates, younger people, who've had a very hard time finding employment in this economy, especially after 2008. And they are stuck with loan payments that are required of them every month, fixed amounts, and they can't afford them. That's led to 6 million defaults so far, and about 12 to 15 million people who are chronically delinquent in making these payments. One of the problems for them is that Congress has made it illegal to discharge student loan debt through bankruptcy. So even if they are unemployed, have no resources, and no real prospects for the future, and are suffering under a mountain of debt which prevents them from participating in the economy, they can't get out from under that debt because that debt cannot be discharged. In 1998, Congress made it illegal to discharge federal student loans through bankruptcy. And more outrageously, in 2005, they made it illegal to discharge a private debt between a student and a bank through bankruptcy. So the government's created a situation where it's impossible for students who are unemployed or underemployed to make their payments. How many students fit that category? Well, in 2012, a think tank at Northeastern University estimated that more than half of the previous year's national graduating class, that is, the class that graduated in June 2012, more than half of them were unemployed or underemployed, meaning that they either didn't have jobs, were working in unpaid internships, or were flipping hamburgers with bachelor's degrees or doing other menial work far less than what they expected when they graduated. So we've created a situation where the cost of education has been shifted from the state to the student. The state used to pay for public colleges and community colleges. Now those institutions have very high tuition that makes them inaccessible to working class kids. So students have to borrow $20,000 to $40,000 a year to attend college. That never used to be true. When they get out, they land in an economy which cannot provide for all of them the kinds of jobs that they need to pay off those debts, and they can't discharge the debts through bankruptcy. So in effect, they're in a debtor's prison without walls, and they are prevented from participating in the economy. What does that mean? It means that if they don't have credit ratings, they can't rent apartments. Many of those people are living in their parents' basements for that reason. without credit rating, they can't start businesses. They can't buy automobiles. They can't purchase homes. Many of these people are forestalling first marriages or forestalling having children because of this economic constraint. So we are damning a good portion of an entire generation to this kind of economic hardship, all because the banks are taking an enormous amount of money out of this system and keeping it for profit. In my book, I have calculated that the banks have probably made something on the order of $800 billion in profits from student loans over the past several decades. That amount of money has got to have played a role in the current income and wealth inequality that's also inhibiting the larger American economy. So we have a crisis here that starts with student loans, but has tentacles that reach out to many other sectors of the economy and many other issues.
And again, I'm speaking with Bill Zimmerman, an author, longtime activist, and one of the nation's most experienced political media consultants. He's the author of Troublemaker, a memoir from the front lines of the 60s, and his latest book is The Student Loan Swindle: Why It Happened, Who's to Blame, How the Victims Can Be Saved. And he has an article at the Huffington Post, How to Save the Victims of the Student Loan Crisis. So the Higher Education Act of 1965 essentially started us on this road. It created a risk-free business for banks, but then it essentially, you know, the government, as the people's advocate, if you will, relinquished that role and became boosters for the banks. And now we're at a situation where in your new e-book, The Student Loan Swindle, Why It Happened, Who's to Blame, How the Victims Can Be Saved, you're essentially giving this book away. It's on Amazon and other places for 99 cents. The purpose, I imagine, being that students are broke, they can't afford it. You're trying to organize a whole student movement in terms of a dissident movement, or in fact a strike, if you will. And the idea is that you want to get all these kids that are indentured in this way to be able to communicate with each other, form a lobby, and then force change. Is that a summary of your strategy?
Yes, exactly, Ian. The crisis can be fixed with two government reforms. One is to make all interest on student loans nonprofit. That would be the equivalent to the Fed's discount rate, the rate that banks have to pay to borrow money from the Federal Reserve. It's currently 0.75%. So I'm arguing that that rate should be applied to all student loans retroactively. The second reform that's needed is to make payments income-based. That is, take a percentage of the student's monthly income after essentials are paid for, like food and housing, and have that percentage of the remaining money be the money due for the monthly payment. That's called income-based repayment. Now, the government's never going to institute these two reforms because the banks have too much power. So the borrowers have to accumulate enough power to neutralize the banks and force the government to make the changes necessary. How do you get that power? I think you can get it through an internet site that would ask people to make a pledge to stop making their payments when 5 million other people make the same pledge. That means that over the course of a year or two, the number of people making this pledge would gradually increase. The threat of 5 million people withholding payments simultaneously might be enough to actually force change on government prior to them actually having to stop making their payments. If, on the other hand, it doesn't, and 5 million people stop making payments on the same day, the government and the banks will not be able to punish them because they'll be overwhelmed. They don't have the resources to deal with 5 million people simultaneously. So the notion here is a strike, but it's the kind of strike where you say, I'll strike if he strikes. You don't just stop making payments. you create political power by accumulating lots of people all committed to making the same act on the same day, and then you use that power to negotiate a settlement. I think that's a practical solution. I think people who are holding student debt are angry enough to do something like this. I think it takes a little leadership to jumpstart it, and I'm trying to work with people around the country to provide that leadership.
Well, ironically, of course, the president's close friend, Arne Duncan, is supposed to provide leadership. He's the Secretary of Education. The Education Department is not only a part of the problem, they're also a part of this kind of mafia-like collection that goes on to collect these debts. It's so bad that the new Consumer Financial Protection Bureau has castigated the Department of Education for their strong-arm tactics in screwing the last dime out of these indentured students.
Well, there are so many abuses in this system that we could talk about. You know, the banks now will not provide loans to students unless those loans are co-signed by a family member or somebody else. So that if the student defaults on the loan, the family member then becomes fully responsible for paying it off. That's left a lot of parents in the lurch, and many of them have lost their homes because they're unable to pay off the student loans. Even worse, a lot of parents are still paying off their own student loans. So when their kids come to them and ask them to co-sign a student loan, they can't do it because they haven't finished paying off their own loans. So the student then goes, in some cases, to a grandparent. And the grandparent, wanting to help his or her grandchild, says, oh, sure, I'll co-sign for you, without fully appreciating the consequences. If the student then defaults on that loan after graduation because he or she can't find a job, the grandparent becomes liable to repay the loan. And right now, a year ago, the number's growing, a year ago, there were 119,000 Social Security recipients in America whose benefits were being garnished to pay off student loans. There are people who are on disability, whose disability is garnished to pay off student loans. There are some outrageous injustices going on, and you mentioned Arne Duncan. He is presiding over a Department of Education that has now gone into the student loan business itself, and the Congressional Budget Office in August of 2013 did a 10-year projection on what the profits would be to the Department of Education over the following 10 years, from 2013 to 2023. They estimated that $184 billion would be realized by the Department of Education in profit on student loans. Now, that profit is the equivalent of a federal tax on working and middle-class student families who are required to take out these loans in order to go to college. It is outrageous that our government is doing something like that with one hand, while with the other, or on one side of its mouth, while with the other side it's talking about wanting to help students who are in a jam as a result of student loans.
Well, you made the point earlier, Bill Zimmerman, that essentially what's happened is that the education, the burden and obligation of education has shifted from the state back to the student. And you've come up with this way to organize students in a kind of civil disobedience or a protest movement via the internet to, once they reach a critical mass of 5 million, to have the lobbying power to force these very reasonable changes, which is, you know, borrowing money at the same rate that banks borrow from the Fed. And I'm just astounded at the lack of outrage. I mean, maybe it's going to take this bubble to burst like it did in 2008. But the problem is, my understanding is that if we have another Wall Street crisis, and if the second one is caused by the student loan debt burden, the government can't bail them out anymore. They cost us $12 trillion last time. There's nothing left in the kitty, is there?
Well, I don't have a good look at the kitty, but I feel the same way you do. I think we have to deal with this crisis before it leads to the kind of meltdown that occurred in 2008. and that if we don't, we're like the frog sitting in the pot of slowly boiling water. We don't understand what's really happening around us and what the potential threat is. This is something that's impacting the lives of millions of Americans who are suffering needlessly, but it's also something that can bring down the economy in a way that would affect all Americans. So while the banks have enormous influence over the government, I think we've got to create some kind of political force to back them away and force the government to defend the public interest, because it's in jeopardy here.
Well, but, you know, unfortunately, the entire education debate, they're talking about the wrong stuff. You know, the arguments are, you know, between the sort of meddling, ego-driven billionaires who want to have charter schools and teachers' unions defending bad teachers. And that seems to be the sort of dynamic that's going on here, when there's a much, much broader issue that we've been talking about here. Why isn't that the priority, just to both rescue our students and rescue our economy and revive our economy, because a whole generation that's indentured is not going to be able to contribute to the economy?
I think that debate is coming, Ian. I think that the problems with education, not just higher education, but all of education, are becoming evident to more and more people in the United States. And we've got to change our overall approach. And in particular, with regard to higher education, we need to apply the same logic that was once applied to primary and secondary education. The government has to provide this service in order to create a healthy democracy and a healthy economy. We need to have an informed and capable citizenry. So we once made the judgment that that requires of government the funding of primary and secondary education. That calculation was made 100 years ago, more than 100 years ago, and it was correct. We now have to make the calculation that higher education is also part of that. Students today need higher education to survive and flourish in this economy, and we need educated citizens in order to run a democracy that's more efficient and capable than the one that we have. So we have to address the problem of adequately educating all of our citizens at all levels, including higher education. That has to be a government responsibility. So that then raises the question, how do you pay for it? How does government get the funds to do that? And the answer is to create a tax structure that deals not just with these problems, but with all the economic problems we have. We have underfunded infrastructure. We have underfunded public services. We have an underfunded healthcare system. And all of those problems get back to the need to create a more equitable tax structure that captures the money necessary for government to provide citizens with the services they need. We once had an income tax structure that took 90% of the marginal income over $200,000. That was back during World War II, when $200,000 was the equivalent of $5 or $10 million today. There's no reason why we can't institute a tax structure like that again, which captures the money that we need to run government. That's the answer, but it's an answer that it's going to take us a long time and a lot of political activism before we can achieve.
Well, Bill Zimmerman, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
You're welcome, Ian. Glad to have been here.
Again, I've been speaking with Bill Zimmerman, an author, longtime activist, and one of the nation's most experienced political media consultants. Previously, he was a strategic communications consultant to MoveOn.org and candidate races that elected Senator Tim Worth, Senator Gary Hart, and Governor Tony Anaya. In 1990, he co-founded the political consulting and advertising firm Zimmerman & Markman, Incorporated, and is the author of Troublemaker, a memoir from the front lines of the 60s. And his latest book is The Student Loan Swindle, Why It Happened, Who's to Blame, How the Victims Can Be Saved. And he has an article at the Huffington Post, How to Save the Victims of the Student Loan Crisis. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.
estamos.